Hello, and welcome to Spotlight On, the podcast that brings together business leaders, entrepreneurs, and experts covering a range of topics. I'm Nicholas Barton, founder and CEO of the Barton Partnership. We're an award-winning executive recruitment and consulting solutions firm providing permanent search and independent consulting services across strategy, sustainability and M&A, data and analytics, and transformation and change. In today's podcast, I'm delighted to be joined by Graham Elton, chairman of the EMEA private equity business at Bain & Company. He's also a leader in the firm's UK media practice and is responsible for the social impact activities of the London office. Graham has extensive M&A commercial due diligence, business carve-out and merger integration experience across a number of industries, and in 2020 was awarded MBE for services to the economy in the Queen's Birthday Honour list. Well, Graham, thank you for joining me today. It's great to see you and certainly appreciate your time for this podcast. Let's get into the first question. Could you start with an overview of your career and from your time at Bain, and certainly talk about sort of your involvement in initiatives like Greater Share?
Yeah, good to see you too, Nick, and thanks for having me on this. Yeah, my career at Bain actually started 2001. I joined Bain as a partner. So I actually had a bit of a career before that, started off at BCG, and then went into the media industry for a number of years, running businesses at Pearson and United News and Media. And then went into the investment business, a firm owned by TPG, Kleiner Perkins, and Bain. That's how I got to know Bain. Cutting a very long story short, joined Bain 2001 as a partner to do media and private equity. Was in the right place at the right time, really, as the private equity balloon went up. So been very lucky with that, and run the private equity practice at Bain and EMEA for many years. Now chair of that. And have begun doing many other things outside of Bain, all related to business information, which is an area I know quite a lot about from my media days, to private equity, to business services, but also to education, which has been a passion of mine for many years. And I've been involved with a number of education not-for-profits. I now chair something called Now Teach. I'm on the board of the Education Endowment Foundation and of National Youth Theatre. And Greater Share is really where education meets private equity, and it's the private equity industry getting behind the educational needs globally. So the GPs that are part of the Greater Share Fund of Funds are donating their fees and carry, and the investors in the Greater Share Fund of Funds are donating half of their net returns, and all of those monies are going to 8 selected NGOs, education NGOs globally. So yeah, I'm one of the founders of Greater Share. I've also, for my sins, got involved with chairing a number of private equity portfolio companies, currently doing 4 of those, and getting involved with a spin-out private equity fund, which is now raising Fund 2. So fairly diverse set of activities, lots of them in and around the private equity industry over many years.
What do you put Bain's success down to when it comes to the Bain private equity ring fence division, renowned for being perhaps the strongest from a consulting perspective in advising private equity firms?
Yeah, no, very good question. Look, a big piece of it comes from first mover advantage and from really thinking like a private equity investor. As you know, Bain is where Bain Capital comes from. It grew up inside Bain and then left home and has lived on its own for many years, but is a member of the extended family. And really, that was what started the ring fences. If the Bain technology works for one GP, it could work for many. So when Bain Capital left home, the private equity group at Bain started and making that Bain technology available to many. And it grew so quickly and so well that it's been a really important part of the firm now for 25 plus years. And that means the whole firm gets behind what we do in private equity. So when people engage Bain in a private equity deal or a portfolio company, they know they're getting the whole of Bain behind that. We're wired to do that work here. We get it. Everyone here gets it. We have a big co-invest fund. A lot of people are investors in that. We've got an investor mindset that runs through a lot of Bain, which I think makes us even more helpful than we might be otherwise.
Oh, fantastic. Everyone's talking about AI right now. Clearly, obviously, it's become the forefront of many topics in organizations as well as private equity. Given the growing integration of AI in private equity, what do you perceive as the most significant use cases of AI
across the deal lifecycle, and how is Bain capitalizing on this, both internally and in client engagements?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. This is one of the top of the list questions in any meeting that we're having, when we're looking at a deal, when we're working with a portfolio company, or when we're helping a private equity firm with its strategy. And we're really seeing AI, Gen AI, being used across the whole of the deal lifecycle now. Really interestingly, starting with that area of sourcing and screening, using these tools enables funds to scour the market much more efficiently and effectively than they were able to do before, for the sorts of deals that they want to be doing, things that are likely to be transactable, providing some insights and some angles. And actually at Bain, we've developed a tool called Helix, which enables people to do that very, very rapidly and on an ongoing basis, which is an exciting tool. Into the diligence area, clearly, Gen AI has got a lot of value to bring. Private equity firms amass a huge amount of information pre, during, post deals. They've had these things over many, many years. Actually being able to manage that knowledge and pull from that knowledge the things that are pertinent to a deal that you're looking at the moment, Gen AI is clearly a tool that is very helpful. So in terms of knowledge creation and knowledge management, and really allowing deal teams to increase the quality and the speed to insight on things that they're doing. And then there are things that are actually just really helpful productivity as well. We've developed a tool here called Dialogue AI, which transcribes and manages interview data, because we do lots of interviews. Actually getting all of that information into a pool that you can then ask questions across it to pull out of all of that data the different answers to questions that maybe you didn't ask in the interview, but someone's interested in. That's pretty interesting as well.
And these are products that Bain have developed themselves.
Yes. So Bain has a relationship with OpenAI, which has enabled us to get out in front, really, of developing quite a few of these tools, not just for ourselves, but actually with some of our clients as well, for them and for their portfolio companies. And that whole area within portfolio companies, and the work started when this became very much the subject of the day, with doing the diagnostics of people's portfolios. So looking at where the disruption risks might be from Gen AI, where the opportunities might be, and generating those sort of scorecards of which portfolio companies they should be rolling their sleeves up and doing things on. But now it's actually people getting on and doing things and developing proof of concepts, and then actually getting into really industrializing some of those. And one of the companies that I chair is a company called J-Man Group, which is a data consulting business. They're very much in the center of this space as well, really helping companies professionalize their data so that they can use that data in AI applications. Because clearly, if you haven't got your data sorted out, you're not going to be able to do these things. They're also in the space of really helping people take those proof of concepts into something that is sustainable, rigorous, and industrialized to be able to roll out through the organization. So I'm seeing quite a lot from that angle as well. J-Man works pretty well exclusively with private equity portfolio companies. So seeing a lot of activity there as people are rolling their sleeves up and getting on.
We know Anoush well. He's really created a niche there in that with that proposition, right?
Yes, and whether it's people looking at things around sort of enhanced customer proposition or things around workforce efficiency, there's a lot to be done there in many portfolio companies. And so I think once people have prioritized the portfolio companies where they want to harness Gen AI and do things, then they quickly get to this. So how do I do it? How do I get my data to work for me? And that's where someone like J-Man comes in.
Interesting. Your predictions regarding professionalization of the PE value creation market, both at the fund level and within portfolio companies. What are your thoughts on that?
It's an ongoing game, that, really. I think we are probably into the next chapter of it, because it's going to be tougher over the next few years as we see multiple compression. The deal markets have been quite slow, so prices have stayed fairly high, even with macroeconomic drivers perhaps going in the wrong direction. which all mean people are going to have to work harder to get returns. So the things that were bought 2 or 3 years ago at higher multiples, even the things bought today, there's some sleeves rolling up to be done. And that means that people put more effort into their portfolio value creation tools and teams. And so I think we'll see another round of professionalization of that. I think we've over the last several years seen a lot of focus on growth and on revenue growth. I think we're going to see an increasing focus on margin over the next period, and probably some of those skills and tools are going to be ones that will be developed further. We've of course talked about Gen AI and digital, which will play roles both in growth but also in margin maintenance and ideally margin enhancement. But historically, private equity has found it more difficult to grow margin than to grow revenues, and that's an area I think that will come under increasing focus.
Obviously, we've talked about AI, but one of the other critical topics has always been ESG. With the rise of ESG function in private equity funds, what are the key factors contributing to the effective integration of ESG into investment strategies? I guess from your experience, what differentiates a successful ESG approach right now within private equity?
The vital word you mentioned there is integrating. I think when this started, people maybe thought they should have an ESG office. And someone with the ESG badge, almost that sort of CSR like, and that was what was required. I think people have moved on from that now. The real leaders in this have integrated ESG into all parts of the deal value chain and into all parts of the organization. So it's no longer a specialist operation, but actually the deal teams get it. They understand the ESG drivers of value, and they're looking for those. The portfolio teams understand what it takes to deliver those, and they're high on their agenda. The IR teams are spending a lot of time really understanding the ESG requirements of their clients, the LPs, and where that's going as they think about developing both their marketing materials, but also the firm as a whole, developing their products, their next range of funds. So It's I think, something which we will cease talking about as an individual function and talk more about something that is pervasive through the whole organization. And the funds that are doing that best, the firms that are doing that best, are the ones that are out there ensuring it's integrated across the whole. If you want to buy an ESG piece of work, whether it's as part of your firm or fund strategy or ESG diligence or looking for ESG value creation opportunities. But I think we practice what we're preaching a little bit here. We see it as an integral part of that. You can't do a firm or fund strategy now without thinking about ESG, because it's really important to your customers, to the LPs. You can't do a diligence without thinking about the ESG angles on it, because it's certainly going to affect value creation, certainly going to affect exit. You can't really be looking at doing a value creation plan without taking those factors into account. There are real, and we find this an exciting area to be working in, because there are real opportunities to create value within businesses by being able to get a price premium because of the decarbonization effect of what's being done, to be able to reduce costs by being more efficient in use of power or use of water. No, to change the way that a sector works by using fewer vehicles on the road, to be reducing the amount of wastage, to reducing the amount of returns. All of these things are great ESG, but they're also great for the financial returns of the business.
Yeah,
they make you more profitable during your ownership period and make the business a lot more sellable at the end.
Private equity has witnessed an influx of capital into the energy transition space. What impact do you foresee on this having for both the global climate agenda and the industry itself?
Yeah, I think private equity's got a very real role to play in decarbonisation. I think two ways, really. There's the decarbonisation of their portfolios, and a lot of GPs have set targets for decarbonisation across their portfolios. A lot of LPs have set targets for decarbonisation across their investment portfolios, and GPs need to be cognizant and aware of that and working with that. you know, a lot are working hard with them. We'll actually budget on that as part of their diligence as they go into owning a business on what it's going to take to reduce carbon emissions during their ownership period. So that's happening within portfolios, and that's across many parts of the private equity industry. And then, of course, you're seeing a number of firms launching, whether it's adding to their portfolios or new to the market firms, launching carbon reduction funds. Now, a lot of money going into those, and there are some very substantial plays out there with General Atlantic and Brookfield and others attracting large sums of money into the space for into transition funds. So it's a vibrant area in itself. But I think, again, a bit like when we were talking about ESG, it's across the piece.
From your perspective then, in your experience, what are the key factors now that are driving superior returns in private equity funds' value creation process? And how do these relate to the composition and focus of PE operation teams?
The risk with a question like this is that you can list many, many things. And
sure.
I think there's always a value in trying to pick a few. We are seeing people focus particularly on our talent.
Yeah.
Which has always, everyone has always known that talent is a significant driver of value.
Yeah.
But how do you identify, measure, maintain, develop talent? That is becoming an increasingly important part of value creation planning, indeed of deal assessment on the way in. Another one, I've mentioned it, we've talked about it with relation to AI, but it's broader than that, is data. And both from my Bain and from my J-Man vantage points, I can see that so many private equity firms now putting even more emphasis on getting on top of data within their businesses, because the data is gold dust. If you get that right and the data right, you can really drive change within the business much more effectively than if you haven't got a grip of that. And so with all of the advances in digital broadly and Gen AI in particular, that the importance of getting on top of the data questions and understanding the power of the data within the organization, I'd probably put as the second. And the third one, I'd actually use the word focus. There are too many value creation plans that do become laundry lists, and they lose their power by doing so. They're the most effective value creation plans that I have seen are ones that are really focused on a small number of things that are going to make a very large difference. And the organization lines up behind them and pursues them relentlessly. So I think those three things are probably, when you say impact on the portfolio teams, I would say those three things, if they've got three things to really have top of the list, it's talent, it's data, and it's...
And when you talk about talent, can we just elaborate on that one? When you say talent, you mean the evolution of talent within the business, sort of bringing in new skills and capability? What do you mean by talent specifically?
We can all write very good plans, but the plans only become reality when someone does something with them. And do you have the right talent in the right places in the organization to deliver the plan? Most people will say the reason things didn't turn out how they had planned is because they had some talent issues. So getting on top of that, anticipating those and addressing those, I think is a very high order priority.
So that leads really well into the next question then, which is, how is the emerging role of the Chief Transformation Officer reshaping strategies and practices within PE funds and their portfolio companies?
Yeah, I would say it's less within funds. I'm not really seeing much of a Chief Transformation Officer role at the funds level. There, we're seeing quite a lot of Chief Digital Officer or Chief Data Officer. Those are more likely roles at the center, or even a CTO, Chief Technology Officer. The Chief Transformation Officer, I think, is at the portfolio company level, and seeing that becoming quite a regular idea appointment, part of almost the value creation plan, almost goes hand in glove with the value creation plan, being involved with the development of that, but then becoming the person that is responsible for staying on top of it, working very closely with the CEO, obviously, to ensure that any blockages are removed, that the cross-company coordination that needs to take place is taking place, and that the value creation plan stays as part of the central nervous system of the whole organization rather than becoming some parallel activity whilst everyone goes back to their day jobs. So Chief Transformation Officer is a big role, really important role, needs to be a top table role rather than a staffer role several rungs down the organization, and needs to be someone that knows how to do it. The Chief Transformation Officer isn't something you just get up in the morning and say, I'll go and have a go at that. There's some real skills required, some real experience required.
Yeah, we said from our perspective, we tend to find it's individuals with a track record of implementation and impact, right? It's people, It's not the theoretical side of strategy, it's the delivery side, right?
Absolutely. I can't overstate the importance of the relationship with the CEO, because the Chief Transformation Officer is working with the borrowed or delegated authority of the CEO. And the organization needs to see that the Chief Transformation Officer is the CEO's agent, that they are working very, very closely together. If it looks like there's a big gap between the two of them, or the CEO isn't fully trusting them, then the Chief Transformation Officer isn't really going to be able to do their job.
Well, look, Graham, final question, crystal ball. Looking ahead, what major trends or shifts do you anticipate in the PE sector, and how should firms prepare to navigate these changes?
Yeah, these are questions actually that I do spend quite a lot of time on. A lot of the work I'm doing at Bain is with private equity firms on their own strategy. And so these questions are ones that we're thinking about all the time. But I think we've said for many years that the private equity world is bifurcating a bit between those that are going to be scale players and those that are really going to be focused on their differentiation. They are just going to be really, really good at a smaller number of things. And I think that bifurcation is going to continue. I think we're going to see the scale players get even bigger, and they are going to do that somewhat organically, but increasingly through M&A. We're going to see more deals done, particularly by the listed entities, but also by those that are not listed. So we're going to see more consolidation. And the big part of the market, which is already quite a share of the total market, is going to get bigger. That doesn't mean that there's no space, there's no air for the rest, but it does mean that to succeed in the remaining parts of the market, those firms have really got to excel on one or two things, those points of differentiation. Just being a smaller version of a large fund, doing a bit of everything, isn't going to hack it at all going forward. So I think we are seeing those very different plays, and the ones that are playing the scale game are really thinking hard about how they get the advantages of scale, where they should go next in that scale game. And those that are playing the differentiation game are really looking at how do we sharpen our differentiation and make sure that it endures. So that's probably the first one. The second one is the growth of retail, which many have talked about. Many firms now are doing things about it. The amount of retail money coming into private equity is going to grow significantly faster than the institutional money coming into private equity. If you want to be a scale player, you've got to be tapping into that retail money. If you're not a scale player, you've got to think about whether you want to be tapping into that retail money, and if so, how you're going to do it. I think increasing the amount of the market that is retail means that people will be thinking about product as well. How do they develop their products to be more appealing to the retail market? So we'll be looking at increasing liquidity. We'll be looking at increasing information sharing. I think those are all trends that people need to be on top of and deciding if they're going to play, how they're going to play. And then the third one, we wouldn't be surprised, that is this whole data Gen AI space. That's only just started, the impact that's going to have on the private equity industry.
Do you see any opportunity for consolidation across private equity? Do you see smaller firms? Yeah.
But being led by the big players who have got the ability to go out and acquire and integrate. They will be acquiring for geographic expansion. They'll be acquiring for asset class, moving into other asset classes. For the listed ones, growing AUM is a vital driver of keeping their share price moving. But they also see, along with some of the scale players that aren't yet listed, that to continue to compete at the large end of this market, you've got to keep growing at least the rate of the market. And that scale really does bring some advantages in how deep your pockets are for investing in things like Gen AI, like digital, like talent. These things, they cost money. And if you can spread that across a very large AUM, you're going to be able to do more than if you're a small fund. So I think we are going to see more of that. Yeah.
Well, look, Graham, thank you. Brilliant insight. Really appreciate your time today. It's been great talking to you and really getting your insight. Fantastic career to date. And wish you all the best with the various ventures. Don't know how you fit it all in, but with the various ventures you've got on the go at the moment. But thank you for sharing your insight with us today. And look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Many thanks, Nick. See you soon.
Thank you.